We started talking last week about mindfulness with the intent to spend some time with this quality because it's so central to liberation practice, to meditation practice. It's also so central in a strange way to our culture right now. Like whatever it is everywhere in all sorts of interesting ways. So what is this mindfulness thing? As we talked about last week, really just beginning to look at this quality, the word mindfulness is a translation of an early Buddhist word, sati in Pali, smriti in Sanskrit, that literally means memory. It refers to this a mental quality that connects with an experience, especially that connects with a sensory experience and experiences it in the body, in the way that we do when we remember something. What does it mean to remember something? In a way, it means to feel it again, or to connect with it in a conscious way. And so mindfulness has something about being conscious or aware in it, and it has something about connecting in it. And in the earliest texts, the practice of mindfulness is really a list of things to connect to, especially qualities in the body, qualities of feeling, states of mind. In a sense, it's what modern philosophers would call a phenomenology, meaning it's a way to investigate our experience in an experiential way. A simple way to say it is mindfulness means pay attention. Know what you're attending to. What that becomes in practice is a training that asks us to learn to do something that is simple but strangely not so easy. And that has to be practiced for a very long time before it becomes natural. And that is to spend more time with our mind and attention engaged with what's happening right now than engaged with what either happened in the past or might happen in the future. Mindfulness presses against the deep, deep habit in our mind, in our psyche, to be not present. So what does not present even mean? And I'm not sure, actually, in some ways. Here I am. Even if I'm thinking about tomorrow's lunch, I'm still here. We use very casually this term, like being present or not, really to refer to whether my attention is consciously attending to my experience or unconsciously doing something else. And the unconscious you can think of basically like a dream. Like, you're not conscious unless you're practicing lucid dreaming, and that's a core practice in relation to this realm, just to say. The Tibetans really emphasize it, early Buddhists somewhat less so. It's one of the ways to figure out how to be mindful, actually, in an interesting way. Because so much of the time, what our mind is doing is, like in a dream, it's going through scenarios, conversations, activities that are not actually physically happening. So if I'm thinking about something that happened this weekend, and I almost always think about things that have some charge to them, pleasant or unpleasant. So I'm thinking about, you know, a difficult conversation I had, and it's replaying in my mind. I'm pretending I had said better things, smarter, faster, whatever things. In some way, I'm thinking about, I'm imagining a situation that's not physically happening. So we call it being not present. My body's present, but my thoughts are creating another experience. But that's just the words and images that are doing that. What's happening in the present is that I'm in a state. And that state is based in the charge that's there. So if I'm if I'm engaged with chewing on the unpleasant conversation, there's going to be an unpleasant charge. There's going to be some activation, some worry or fear, maybe some shame, maybe some self-protectiveness, maybe some confusion. If those weren't there, I probably wouldn't be chewing on it. We chew on things because there's charge. Something's trying to work its way through. But if I don't notice that, then I'm kind of just wandering through town, my job, my relationships, my whatever. But I'm engaged with something that's not what's happening. It's true in the pleasant as well. Maybe at some point earlier in the day, I saw someone who's attractive. And the idea of connecting with that attractive person stayed with me, maybe as a little burst of fantasy or a long trail of associations. And again, it's a state. It's a state in the body that has a kind of pleasure to it or an urge, a leaning. Or I'm thinking about something that I have to do in my work, and it's creative, but it's also activated. There's a charge of activity in it. That charge fills the body, and it has to express somehow, so it's expressing as thought, as fantasy. In a way, the wandering thought is you can think of it as just the expression of an unmet charge in the body. I'm in a state that's not resolving through activity in the present. Therefore, my mind, my heart, is trying to resolve it in the heaven realms, in the hell realms. I'm reaching into the past and future to try to settle a force that's in me that says, you know, oh, things won't be okay unless this happens. Things would be great if this happened. Things weren't so great when that happened. Oh, things were great when that happened. All these ways that the body is actually finds it challenging, body, mind, heart, all one thing, finds it challenging to rest in the present with the experience that's happening. So mindfulness is the antidote to that. And what it says is that it's possible to tune our attention, to train our attention, to connect, first of all, more directly with physical experience. That's the primary antidote to these realms of the mind, past and future. The primary antidote to being lost in the mind is to be engaged with the body. Because if you're attending to a sensation, that sensation is always happening right now. It's always immediately physically available. You can remember a sensation, but that's memory. That's different. That's a thought. It's a state. But engaging with actual physical present sensation is happening now. And this is mysterious because I could have a memory that triggers a sensation. Right? I remember the difficult conversation, my body gets kind of hot in the present. I bring my attention to that sensation. That's actually one of the best ways to process that difficult thing rather than thinking about it. Because in the body right now, the force moves through. And it moves through in the way that it can actually resolve, which is through sensation. It's much easier for bodily force to resolve through sensation and feeling, emotion, than it is through story, narrative, concept, thought. You don't understand your way through heartbreak. You feel your way through it. You don't understand your way through grief. You feel through it. You don't understand your way through almost anything. You feel through it. So then mindfulness is this quality that we could call present moment attention. It manifests when I can stay with what's happening for long enough to recognize it, basically. So like, here comes a breath, it's more or less pleasurable, kind of neutral. I can sense it, and I can sense it for long enough to say to myself, this is an in-breath. mindfulness is absent or less strong when, you know, maybe the breath starts and some part of me goes breathing, but then the mind instantly goes somewhere else. Mindfulness strengthens as we not just connect with sensations or experience in the moment, but we sustain that connection. This is very interesting because at its heart, we're still talking about time. We're still talking about how do we relate to that which has already happened and that which has yet to happen. Because to relate to those things, we have to touch them with our minds. We have to think about them or feel into them. But as soon as we drop below the level of story, narrative, discursive thought, we find the body with sensation and emotion. We find its watery or windy or hot and cold aspects, its pressures and pains and aches and longings that are physical, not mental. And connecting with any of those, pleasant or unpleasant, brings us into the body's immediacy. It turns out this is really healthy. It's really good for you to do this. It seems to reduce the kind of anxiety and stress that we carry around so often. Anxiety and stress so often are mind-driven. The same stories running again and again through the mind. Of course, mindfulness will help that, if you can do it. If we can do it, it invites a kind of restful, settled quality. Because so much of the feeling of being unsettled is also in the mind. Even if I'm moving quickly to get somewhere, let's say I'm driving, I'm a little bit late, my body's not moving very much in my musculature, driving. I'm not expending a lot of energy, I'm just sitting there in my comfortable or uncomfortable car. The body's just there. Why am I ramped up? I'm ramped up because I'm thinking about being late. I'm ramped up because I'm holding a concept that has narrative and time. But in this very moment, I'm sitting in a vehicle, stopped at a stoplight. My body is still. Why would I not be able to just feel quite at rest? Because the mind doesn't stop even when the body stops. So then mindfulness that takes us out of the spinning mind and into the life of the body calms that kind of anxiety, that kind of stress. Turns out that being present in that way seems to be good for creativity. You just don't have the same kind of ideas when you're really worried about what's happening, what's going to happen next. Or you have to drop into a space of embodied presence before almost anything juicy that we really, really like in our lives happens. With presence, breathing is better, eating is better, talking to people we like is better, doing our work is better. Sometimes. And that's the place where it starts to get interesting. Here we've got this practice that says, come out of past and future. Come into the life of the body. Stress goes down. Restfulness goes up. Ease can arise. Turns out it's pretty pleasurable to be resting in the present in the body. Even if the body's in pain, it's better to be with it in a simple way, if we can, and that's always the caveat, than it is to be spinning in the realms of fear and anger and confusion. But it's very interesting then that mindfulness has become the you know, the panacea for everything in the world right now, in the Western world. Businesses want to teach their employees to be mindful. Why? Partly because having less stressed employees seems to be a good thing. But what if it really works? If people stop thinking about the future so much, rest in the present body. One recent study found that after a brief mindfulness practice, folks appeared, you know, in a sort of functional psych testing kind of way, the data suggested that folks who did a mindfulness-based practice were less motivated to do stupid tasks after their bit of mindfulness. They were asked to do this some sort of data entry kind of thing. And the people who had, you know, done some other thing, the placebo, whatever it was, some affirmations or read the New Yorker for a while or whatever it was, they were like, okay, they just did the data entry task. And the people that did the mindfulness practice weren't as interested. They didn't do it as well either. I have a friend who worked for a while high up in one of the big corporate mindfulness programs. Big company, big program, lots of money, lots of people going through their own in-house mindfulness training thing. And at some point I was like, how's it going? And my friend said, you know, it's great. Like, it's helping lots of people be happier and be less stressed. It's awesome. I love it. I said, yeah. What else? She said, you know, don't publicize this, and it's off the record, but we're tracking attrition. People are doing the mindfulness course and then quitting their job and going off to, you know, go to Bali for a year or spend more time with their kids or just get a less stressful job. One of the main critiques of corporate mindfulness is that by emphasizing that people can do this thing that'll reduce their own personal stress, essentially by not engaging, it teaches people to be passive in relation to their situation. That is not untrue. Right? At the heart of mindfulness is shifting our relationship to our experience. In this moment, the sitting posture that I'm in is creating a tiny bit of unbalanced sensation such that my left sit bone is a little bit more pressure-y on the blanket than the right, and it's creating a tiny tilt in my pelvis that is ringing through my left glute and up into my SI joint with a tiny little thread of discomfort. I can do one of two things upon noticing that. I can fix it by changing my posture, or I can let it be. And central to mindfulness practice is the recognition that comfort and discomfort are in flux all the time, they come through all the time. I can make that choice, but we discover very quickly that constantly trying to adjust my situation in microscopic ways to keep it comfortable is a losing game. You just can't do it. I know you're trying. It's very cute how much we try to do that, right? Like, oh, you know, like adjusting my diet in all these different ways and getting my exercise just right and getting my wardrobe just right and getting my partner just right and getting, you know, and then, you know, don't even think about working on the civic level and trying to sort of, you know, address what's wrong out there. Yeesh. You're doomed. So then the practice comes along and says, see that clearly. Because the process of trying to fix everything is being lost in past and future. It is saying, oh, this tiny little thread of discomfort in my hip If I played that out into the future, it might continue. It might get worse. I might get injured. Or at the very simplest, it's really just like, I don't like that. I don't want to live like this. I want to be comfortable and happy all the time. Like, that's the impulse. I'm failing at that because I have a body and I'm alive. Like, the best way to be comfortable and happy eternally is to, in the Buddhist framework, to get enlightened. But in the ordinary person's framework, at least, it's just to die. Like, just be done. Especially if you've recovered from, you know, monotheisms of any kind, and you've let go of the idea of an eternal heaven or hell. If your view of what happens here is that you're alive until you die, and then when you die, it's just nothing, why not just go there? There's less suffering. There's none. It's going to be great. Empty, but great. Right? If that's the view, and just to say the Buddha categorically said that was wrong view, so that's not how it is according to the Buddhist system. There is more than that. But mindfulness suggests in this very interesting way that if you let go of the future, if you stop trying to fix things, a lot stops, not just stress. What if being free of stress also meant being free of ambition? What if being free of stress also meant being free of getting what you want in the future? Like, you know, a different material circumstance or a different partner or a material circumstance. Becoming present is a strange thing to do. If you start really getting into Buddhist practice or yogic practice, any of the systems that value this kind of very immediate presence, very immediate embodied, just what's happening now presence. Meaning you start going on retreats, you start living at Dharma centers, you start spending a lot of time with people who are doing this full time. There's a whole mess of them, us, out there. Relatively soon, if you get serious about this kind of practice, you shift out of a world of folks who are doing it in order to have a better ordinary life, like coming to yoga classes or going to a meditation group in order to do their work or their relationship better. That's basically the folks who want the stress reduction and the brightening of creativity and joy, but don't want the deeper implications that are like, let go of everything I want, like everything. I don't want to do that. You don't have to do it. But if you go seriously toward this present moment thing, such that it starts to feel really good, and you start to get some of the benefit, actually, of it, your life simplifying, your mind simplifying, the heart clarifying, you might find that you want to hang out longer in that state. But you can't do that and keep your job. For a while you can futz it, but eventually if you want to hang out there, you're not going to get your taxes done. You're not going to file your paperwork on time because you have to be engaged in narrative and past and future to do all that stuff. And all that stuff is great. No problem, right? But mindfulness, I think the thing I'm getting at tonight is that mindfulness is not a casual self-help regime. Mindfulness is the heart of the liberatory path in Buddhism. It is the thing that turns you away from fixation and constriction in your life. But it also completely deconstructs, for instance, identity. Who are you, right? Who you are in some ways, the felt sense of your story, your whole narrative, your whole life. I was this and that. I was born in Illinois. I was adopted. I'm half Puerto Rican. I do these things and that things. I was a musician. Now I'm a ex-musician, whatever. Who knows? That's just past. That's the story of the past. It's a nice story. I had a fine story. You know? A sort of medium, boring, kind of minimalist contemporary drama. Not a horror story. Not really a porn story. I wanted that. Not a romantic story until it was. That was very nice. You know? Now it's a complicated, you know, family story. All family stories are complicated family stories. That's just story. All of that is story. It's fine. But in the very, very immediacy of the mindful orientation, that story goes away quickly, actually. What's left is actually a pretty quiet, open space. It's actually a pretty interesting life. But if you go and hang out with the folks who are doing that, you instantly find a whole class of people that are very dear to my heart, the sort of contemplative misfits. I'm looking at you. Contemplative misfits. Folks who actually spent a lot of time doing that in that space. But that also, in many cases, means didn't make any money for 20 years, didn't set up an IRA, didn't have a family. Some do, some don't. Mindfulness comes from a tradition of folks who would leave the family life and go out into the wilderness and live in intentional poverty and celibacy, bringing their hearts and minds toward this profound stability and resting there and seeing what happens if you rest there, like really, really rest there day after day, letting go of the future so radically that birth and death start to sort of merge into just one oscillating field of being. You keep going. The sense of being a self, the narrative falls away. You know, it's interesting that when we tell the story of the Buddha, we only tell the story of him not enlightened. We tell the story of, like, a rich young man who was sheltered, who was, you know, who got confused, who wanted to know about the world, who, you know, left his family to seek, to do these practices, who searched, who had an insight, and then got enlightened. How many times have I heard that story? And then the teacher says, and then he taught for 45 years, walking all around, teaching everybody. What does that mean, if that's the narrative? What it means, and this is literal in many places in the canon, is that the story stops with liberation. And liberation is the result of radical mindfulness. The story just ends. Who is the Buddha after his enlightenment? He's a person that called himself the one thus gone and gave a detailed but repetitive series of teachings constantly for the rest of his life. And the only narrative points in that story after the enlightenment are the things that other unenlightened people did. Oh, the king killed his brother, his father. It's like, so there's that narrative. Oh, the Buddha's cousin tried to take over the community from him. There was a big schism. There's that narrative. In other words, the story only goes on when unenlightened people do stuff. But the liberated ones, there's no story. This becomes a strange sort of litmus test for spiritual teachers. If they've got a really dynamic narrative that goes on and on and on through their life, you can be sure that something's unresolved, I think. The ones who resolve their narrative fully don't seem to generate further drama. Sometimes drama happens around them. Other people do things. Mostly this means most of the enlightened teachers are only semi-enlightened. So a whole range. But just take a moment to finish. Do the gesture of mindfulness for a moment. And you can do it, one of the easiest ways to do it is just to quickly scan through your senses, to notice what you're seeing in the immediate physical space, color, light, texture, objects, people, floor, walls, recognizable things. This is what's this is what's here now. The inner image is elsewhere, but this is what's here now. Tune in to sounds. These are the sounds happening now. This hum, that whine, that roar, these words, your own sounds. Tune into smells and tastes and physical sensations. And again, it doesn't matter if they're pleasant or unpleasant. That's a different investigation. Mindfulness itself, it's enough to just say, oh look, there's an ache in the hip and a buzz in the shoulder and a softness through the chest. Happening now. This is just what's happening now. There's my mood, there's the charge, energy, the tone, sleepiness, wakefulness. The emotional energies of grasping or pushing away or confusion, those are happening now. Your state is happening now. When you're doing any of that, engaging with the physical, there won't be a discursive thought. Because you can only really do one thing at a time. So you bring yourself fully to a sensation, the thoughts pause for a moment. They're like someone talking at a party, and as soon as you turn your attention away, they wait for you to come back because they don't want you to miss anything. You come back, they just start talking again. You want to get away from them, but they're somehow so compelling. They follow you around. You're like, go away. And wait, a little more. But they're not very nice to you, unfortunately, most of the time. So you would do well to take a break from them. But you can bring your attention to a thought. Think a thought intentionally. Like, think your name. And notice that a thought, some words came through, and you were aware of it. You can be mindful of thought. But if I pause for a few minutes and don't say anything, especially if you're not focused on doing a particular thing like watching the breath or whatever, the annoying person at the party is going to start talking again. What's this guy talking about? We have to do this thing tomorrow. Tomorrow. Yesterday. Oh my God. What? This thing. You. Him. Her. That. Person. You know. Shut up. I actually did do a long retreat at one point where I was practicing pretty concentrated, silent mindfulness, no noting. I would just sit, move through sensations, but then it would just start up. And my primary practice, as soon as I noticed it, was just to go, shh. Which worked, right? It's one long out breath. It's a little tiny action. It's meaningful, right? Treat your mind like a baby, basically. Shh. Quiet, and then restart. But the implications of present moment attention are vast. And what happens when we let go of past and future changes everything. So, your thoughts, feelings here, anything you notice in doing it, that especially ways that you might be able to perceive, I think you really can perceive the radical aspect of this practice, even tasting it just a tiny bit. If you really tune into what it could mean to have access to this space, this state that's not embedded in time in the same way. Any thoughts and feelings here as we open into our discussion? Yeah.
So it feels to me to be mindful to be very simple, it's very deep. And then to be in the clutter, it's very complicated and it's very shallow.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so I do like the deep place, and it has had that result of not really caring, but I'm in a position where I don't have to work on it. So how do I hold all that noise people are and what does it look like in terms of social justice and people suffering yeah. when you're, like, I don't know how to balance
yeah.
that.
Yeah. It's such a good question. I think it's really one of the core questions. Partly why I want to speak about mindfulness and flesh out some of these things is that there's this message, mindfulness is awesome for you, it's awesome for activists, it's awesome for everything, but it comes from a tradition that is pretty radical in relation to those things. And it sets up, I think, this exact paradox. Do I go more and more towards stillness and non-engagement, right, which is what stillness is, in a kind of mathematical way, right? Mm-hmm. Or do I maintain engagement? Mm-hmm. And that's just a spectrum, right?
Right.
I think that for a lot of non-monastics, for lay people, so you, folks who are not devoting like 24/7 of their life energy to liberation and stillness, that there's, for each of us, there's a kind of sweet spot in there somewhere. It's a range, you know, where like some amount of resting into stillness is nourishing and uplifting and centering and clarifying and actually gives energy or restores my energy that I then use to engage with what's meaningful to me. And I think that that's the sweet spot that most mindfulness teaching nowadays is going for. It's like healthy enough, peaceful enough, liberated enough to be able to engage with the world in a way that's ethical, dynamic, creative, compassionate, being there for the suffering of the world. This is, in Buddhism, this would be considered essentially a Mahayana viewpoint, even really a tantric viewpoint. And I think probably it's one of the best ways to think of mindfulness practice now is that. And it is possible, and it is one of the implications of mindfulness, that if you start to taste the profound centeredness, as you know, the depth of that one-pointed or one-momented state, it can really feel right to drop away from engagement for a while, to go on to retreat, to have a period of retreating inward in order to move through an inner process that's demanding. And I'll propose that, you know, in a world where there's almost no monastics anymore, like even 100 years ago, there were thousands and thousands of monastics in the Christian world. Now there's a few. Right? How many people know more than one or two monks or nuns? How many people know any monks or nuns? Right? Right, good, right? You're a good Buddhist, you know a few. How many people know 100? My parents probably knew 100 monks and nuns at Catholic school, they were everywhere for a while. They're not there. We don't have a contemplative profession or vocation that a lot of people are doing. So I'll propose that in the absence of a strong monastic tradition remaining, that there is a place within lay practice for folks who are drawn to full-time contemplative practice. And that we need that as a culture. Not everyone needs to be out and engaged. But to delude ourselves and think that we're being engaged when in fact we're being neither fully engaged in inner work nor actually doing anything, is a kind of, there's a dull spot. And this dull spot is actually what our culture loves for us to live in. That's the spot of being a consumer, and, you know, being one who primarily consumes entertainment and doesn't actually engage. It's neither externally liberating, meaning moving the social justice ball forward, nor is it internally liberating, moving the what are you going to call it? Inner justice ball forward. So that's the zone to avoid, right? Is this like dull realm. Unfortunately, for a lot of us, that's the wide middle of the range. And so for a lot of folks, it's a little bit like, I have to do a lot of inner healing before I can do anything in the world. Mm-hmm. Once I get that inner healing kind of going, I kind of have two options, you know, maybe a few. One is I can get healed enough to live more happily in that dull middle space, right? That's what, I think that's what Freud was referring to when he was like, you know, the goal of therapy can't make anyone like completely, perfectly happy. The goal of therapy is actually just to create ordinary unhappy people rather than like, you know, toxic poison neurotics, you know, pathological suffering people. I'm not that fond of that characterization. I prefer my healing modalities to do better than that. But he wasn't wrong, right? Like you can do a bunch of healing and you can land in the broad middle of the bell curve and watch some nice TV and, you know, not hurt people too badly. Muddle along. And that's a fine life, especially if the trauma's been intense as it has for so many. And there's more. And the more is that like, oh, if I can do some of my work, some healing work, to get out of that dull, that frozen really, or numb bubble, then really all that means like more energy is available. My life energy becomes more available to me. I do some yoga, I do a bunch of practice, I get some therapy, I open my system. Once there's more energy, I have some choice. And then at that point, I'll say that the choice that's wholesome is going to be whatever feels most right that's not dropping back into dullness or numbness. And so for some people, that's going to be leaping into engagement to do more in the world, to really dig in. That's beautiful when enough healing energy has happened here that someone can dig in a way that's going to, you know, make a difference. For others, actually digging in is going to be delicious. And for those folks, I'll say, don't waste this opportunity, especially if you, you know, aren't in debt, aren't raising young children. Like, if you have some freedom to do that and you're drawn to it, almost nobody is. You know, we'll manage without you for a few years. Like, go do that. Because without folks who go deeply into that stillness, the contemplative traditions won't survive. Right? They'll just become a kind of dull thing. Right? Mindfulness without liberation is so boring and not that useful. Right? So like we need some people to go so profoundly into that that their whole systems blow open. We only need a few in each generation to really keep that alive. But we all have to figure out sort of where our sweet spot of inward rootedness and external action is. And of course, this is just the ancient question. This is Arjuna's question, you know it. So you're just being Arjuna right now. Punk. Cheers. Other thoughts here? Questions?
I see it. Yeah. I don't know if it's differently, but a different angle. Relates to my own path.
Yeah.
That you go, that practice of mindfulness, you quiet the story,
yeah,
and you attend to the moment, so the noise is quieted, that talking voice is, and then you hear other things, and some of those may be these unconscious, the Jungian shadow things may come up, a lot of grief and pain and monsters and bad dreams, and even under there's something that, and that's where maybe virtues, compassion and empathy and love and appreciation of beauty are hiding underneath that. And with that compassion that comes up, there's a call to act in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a natural sort of progression that quieting the mind, working through some of the shit, the shadow stuff,
maybe
through therapy or just whatever, however. And then this... these virtues arise, and then you're called very naturally. It becomes natural to go and help, fight injustice, and help others. And altruism, or what awake, is awoken as a natural instinct.
Yeah.
And and then maybe you get lost in a story with your out, you know, then you get lost in oh, it's not working, I'm not saving the people, you know, the, and you have to go back and sort of work on your mindfulness.
Yep.
So that sweet spot of sort of, and maybe that's where the bodhisattva place is, where you sort of, but it's a practice, you have to keep going back.
It is exactly, and, you know, this quality of compassion, we talk about it in a too facile way. Compassion is a strange quality to arise, you know. You get really quiet and peaceful and really inevitably, like, it always arises at some point. As you say, like, your own stillness works through this field of difficulty. And on the other side of it, there's a deep peacefulness. Some folks, that peacefulness just kind of drops them away. And there's a whole class of enlightened beings in Buddhism called the Pratyeka Buddhas, who are secret Buddhas. They get enlightened without a teacher and they never tell anybody. They kind of just dissolve back into the crowd. Right, which means they're all over the place. So, you know, for you who are here, you're just hanging out, you're incognito. Thank you for being liberated. But for many... Actually, this is the whole thing about sort of light matter and dark matter. We don't know how many Pratyeka Buddhas there are. We know that a number of people who reach that state of deep stillness, deep presence, deep peace, this quality of compassion arises naturally that turns the attention outward. There's this beautiful story of this exact moment for the Buddha. It's said that after he attained his realization and he was resting in the bliss of deliverance, he was hanging out and appreciating the subtlety and the profundity of what he had attained and found for himself. And the thought occurred to him, what I have just found is so subtle, no one will understand. No one would get it if I just told them. People are expecting something else. And said that the deity named Sakka, the king of the gods, which is the early Buddhist parallel to Indra, the ancient Vedic king of the gods. The king of the gods overheard the Buddha thinking this. He just had a thought. But God heard it up in the heaven realm. And it says, you know, as quickly as a strong man might flex his straight arm or straighten his bent arm. That's the metaphor used for quick movement between the realms in the Buddhist text. As quickly as a strong man might unflex his arm, Sakka disappeared from the heaven of the 33 and appeared in front of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. Bowed to him respectfully, circled him, keeping him on his right. And said, so the gods pay respect to the Buddha. Right? And then he says, Blessed One, you're wrong. There are, in fact, beings with little dust in their eyes who would understand what you have to teach. And only then does the Buddha actually look outward with his supernatural vision, the clear seeing that he had won by becoming so clear. He looks out and he sees that it's, so he tests it. He doesn't just believe him, he tests it. He's like, oh, are there? He said, oh, it's true. And what this really means in a certain way is like there are people who have practiced a lot already. They're ripe. They're really ripe. And if you show them this thing you've found, they will get it. And that will be for their benefit. And as soon as the Buddha sees that there are folks who would get it and it would be for their benefit, it's over. He would never again, like, just keep it to himself. He would say, like, I'm an open book. I'm telling you everything that I need to tell you to get liberated. And so his action then is this kind of compassionate uprising. Oh, well then, you know, I'll do it. And he immediately just starts looking for who's going to be a good candidate to hear this wisdom that he obtained. So compassion is so mysterious in that way that it's rooted in profound inner peace and stability, stillness. But then it rises up and it causes beings to move outward and to make relationships and to get involved and to work for the well-being of others. So, you know, it's not random that is the quality that's the heart of the entire Mahayana system, right? Nothing else is as important as that quality that turns you back toward the people. Any other thoughts here? Lovely. Yeah. So.
I just really appreciated early on in your talk when you were talking about when the mind starts thinking about the past or future, turning your attention to the body and the sensation and what's happening. Mm-hmm. And so often when you're hearing instruction about mindfulness, your mind goes into thought and then back to the breath. It's like, leave that alone and go to something different.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying kind of like, look at the manifestation of that in the present. It's your state.
Yes.
And connect with that.
Yes.
On a physical sensation level. To me, that that's huge. I really, really appreciate you saying that.
Yeah.
And I experienced it today. I mean, it was something that was a very real situation for me because I was very present. I was feeling good, and then you know, something happened with a loved one that terrified me and exacerbated my PTSD. And, and
loved ones, why do they do that?
Oh, it was such a struggle, and I named it. I knew it. I said to my husband, "I'm experiencing debilitating anxiety." Rather than "What am I going to do about her?" Mm-hmm. I said, "This is what's happening with me." And then in doing that, I realized that if I wanted to, actually, I realized that what was being called upon of me was to gain stability.
Mm.
And I kept my mind there. Mm-hmm. And I tried to find what would address that.
Yeah.
Or just to be with it.
Yeah.
And so then when I heard you say that, it really, I guess, landed on fertile ground there.
For sure. For sure.
So thank you.
You're welcome. Good going doing that. It's challenging when there's such a strong charge. For sure.
Yeah.
The classic instruction to just note the thought and come right back, it is a mindfulness instruction, but it's mindfulness of a thing. Like, that's mindfulness of breathing, rather than mindfulness as a general quality.
Yeah, yeah.
And that means, whenever you're doing mindfulness of a specific thing, and you're trying to stick with that thing, you're doing concentration practice.
Yeah.
That's a samadhi instruction. That's a stability instruction. So that's training, which is useful. But mindfulness itself is not the coming back to one thing. Mindfulness is the knowing what's happening.
Yeah, but when you said it's stability, when you said samadhi is, it's a stability practice, I get that.
Yep.
But when I was doing what I just said I did, which is more related to what you're talking about, which is mindfulness,
right,
not samadhi.
I would call it inquiry practice.
That's what I needed to do, I feel like, to get stability. If I had tried to do the stability practice,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have gotten to this.
This is why mindfulness is before stability in the sequence of the Eightfold Path, right?
Yeah.
The meditative practices start with effort, right? Discern wholesome and unwholesome states,
mm-hmm.
and support the wholesome and diminish the unwholesome.
Yeah.
Then mindfulness is the quality that recognizes what's happening and makes choices about what to attend to. And then concentration is actually what happens when you know what to attend to that's wholesome and you stick there.
Oh, yeah.
And so the three work in that order. Mm-hmm. And so mindfulness is necessary before concentration can become even a potential.
Can there be concentration of the nervous system instead of the breath?
Of course. You can concentrate on anything.
Yeah.
We choose objects of concentration that are relatively stable.
Yeah.
So if you're concentrating on the nervous system, you're concentrating on something that's oscillating.
Yeah.
Ideally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if you're watching, which the breath also does.
But the breath oscillates too.
Of course,
so.
Of course. It's basically like anything you look at is going to be changing.
Yeah.
But if you look at something that changes and it relatively keeps the same identity, then you're working with a single object, like the breath.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter if you're on the in-breath or the out-breath or the pause. You're tracking the cycle of breath.
Yeah.
Therefore, your mind gets to stabilize on one thing.
Yeah.
Right? But if you were doing like, you know, if you were doing like noting practice of the senses, I would say like seeing, smelling, feeling a sensation, seeing again, sensing temperature, seeing, hearing a sound. And those things have different identities, meaning different labels.
Yeah.
If you're tracking things that have a whole bunch of different labels, then the stable quality is awareness itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the object is changing.
Yeah.
And that's the main difference between those two practices.
Okay, yeah.
Right? Mindfulness with changing objects is essentially cultivating stability of attention within a changing field. That's the inquiry practice. Because it leads to the realization of impermanence
mm-hmm.
and not self. And then its parallel practice is to choose one thing out of that field and stick to it like glue. Ignore everything else for a while mm-hmm. in order to hone the ability to be steady.
Yeah.
And that's the samadhi practice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're new, don't worry about that. A little technical business, but that's what we're talking about in some ways. So, pleasure. Somehow, speaking of Freud, but I think partly just because it sounds good, I've succumbed to calling this little series that we're on right now Mindfulness and Its Discontents. After the book Civilization and Its Discontents. So they mean essentially the same thing. Haha. And we'll continue for a little while looking at some of the aspects, some other aspects of this mindfulness practice, including looking at the classical instructions for what to be mindful of. Because really, maybe we'll talk next week or soon about the difference between the instructions some traditions give to just be mindful of everything that comes and goes, and the orientation in other systems to be specifically mindful of a set of things that are useful to be mindful of and forget about the rest. So, and that's just a strong difference in practice. So we'll look at some of that. Mm-hmm.